Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, what leads people to decide to run for office and what keeps them away from it?
And what do comedy, science, and psychedelics have in common?
But first, U.S. Senate candidates Ruben Gallego and Kari Lake met last night for their first and only debate of the 2024 election cycle. The debate came as recent polls have shown Gallego, a longtime U.S. congressman, with a wide lead over Lake, a former newscaster and gubernatorial candidate. Perhaps unsurprisingly, considering the state of the race, Lake did her best to throw Gallego off his game, which meant that a lot of the debate sounded kind of like this.
But let's be clear.
Yeah, let's talk
you
about
have
the dreamers.
Not
you had a chance
not,
to make a deal.
You are not made clear.
You had a
Would
chance
you,
to make a deal
President
and you
Trump
used
right now,
them
President
as
Trump right
political
now is saying that he's going to deport. She says she's
joining us to break it all down is KJZZ's Wayne Shutsky. Good morning, Wayne.
Good morning.
So let's start by talking about the issue that took up nearly half of the debate, the border. What stood out to you about the way the candidates addressed this issue?
Well, it's just one example of how both candidates are kind of trying to moderate their positions. In this case, it was Gallego. You know, he has in the past, you know, Lake brought up that he called it Trump's dumb, stupid border wall or something to that effect. And, you know, now he's saying, you know, I think a border wall is a part of a solution down there, but we need all these other resources as well. And he pointed to the failed bipartisan border bill that would have provided stuff like technology, more manpower and that kind of thing.
Yeah, it seemed like Gallego was very focused on these kind of procedural solutions, technology, manpower, like you're saying. Lake also seemed like she was trying to create kind of a sense of chaos. She claimed hundreds of thousands of children have been victims of sex trafficking and quoted these giant numbers of people, she kept saying, pouring over the border. What did you make of that approach?
I think it was part of her larger approach to the debate, as you mentioned, to throw Gallego off his game. And, you know, it's kind of part of the Republican playbook right now, Donald Trump as well, to kind of create this sense of fear and that we're the only ones who can fix these problems that are threatening your way of life. So I'll say some of those numbers I believe were inflated, aren't quite backed up by the statistics. But I mean, we can't deny that there has been an increase in immigration and illegal immigration recently until President Biden took some executive action. So I think they're taking that and then they're trying to use that as kind of a lightning rod to attack Democrats more generally.
The other subject that got serious airtime was abortion. This seemed like a moment where Gallego kind of went on offense, no?
Yeah, because this is a strong issue for Democrats. They believe a lot of people, especially in Arizona, are going to be coming out to the ballot on this issue, given that we have our abortion rights constitutional amendment that will be on there. And it's Gallego with the border, Lake's trying to moderate on this now. She had once praised our territorial era abortion ban, you know, near total abortion ban. And now she's trying to say, well, no, I just think it should be up to the states, which is exactly what former President Trump is saying. And Gallego kind of took her to task for that and said, no, like, I have a very strong position on this. You know, it should be legal. He said, you know, whether it passes in Arizona or not, he would support codifying Roe-style protections at the federal level as well.
It seemed like Lake's attempt here was to kind of reframe it as a broader conversation about women's rights and strengthening families.
Yeah, she kind of pivoted and said, you know, but if I do get it to the Senate, what I want to do is provide all of these different family supports for building families, supports for women so that they have other options beyond abortion if they decide that they're not ready to have a child. And that is, again, a kind of part of this Republican playbook, as polling and votes in other states have shown that broadly Americans across party lines do support legalizing some form of abortion access.
The abortion conversation also seemed like a moment in the debate where Gallego really started to challenge Lake about her refusal to acknowledge her defeat in the 2022 gubernatorial election. He said at one point, how can we trust her when she's still lying about the 2022 election? And this was interesting, right? Because Lake was not directly asked about that by the debate moderators.
Yeah, so it was kind of left up to Gallego. I think in his opening statement, even he said she failed the basic test of honesty,
yeah,
referring to her ongoing claims that she won the 2022 gubernatorial race without any evidence, with failed court case after failed court case. And yeah, the moderators didn't ask. So Gallego posed that question to her a few times, and she never answered it. She did not come out to speak with us after the debate. And her surrogates, who did come out, also declined to answer, saying she's answered it before, but she hasn't. She's kind of pivoted, as many Republicans have, to saying, well, people don't trust our elections. But she still won't say, yeah, that was a fair election. I just lost.
Yeah, there was a pretty memorable moment where Gallego asked her directly to say whether or not she won the election. And she said, can I talk about water?
Yeah, because the original question from the moderators was about, water and climate change and that kind of thing. And she initially didn't really answer the part about water. And then and then he answered his question and said, but also, did you lose? And she said, I'd like to talk about water now.
So we mentioned the moderators. One of the other hallmarks of the debate was Lake's fairly persistent interruption of Gallego. We heard that a little bit in the clip that we played. Almost every time he started giving an answer, she would sort of chime in with a provocative question, to the point that towards the end of the debate, you could actually hear one of the moderators say to Gallego, like, jump in, jump in. But Gallego mostly let her get away with that. What did you make of that?
Well, as you mentioned earlier, he is leading in the polls. He's got pretty sizable leads in a lot of the polls we're seeing. And so, you know, typically when that's the case for a politician, some of them skip debates altogether because they don't want to hurt themselves. Well, he showed up, but he also, I think, was just kind of letting Lake be Lake, because one of the biggest weaknesses of her campaign, a lot of people think, is kind of her unlikability, because she is kind of mean, for lack of a better term. And he even said it when Gallego took questions from the press afterwards, that, you know, someone asked him that question, why didn't you fight back harder? And he said, well, he's like, you can fight back without being rude.
Yeah, just a couple, like, really interesting examples of her meanness. There was the one part where she talked about him, quote, sashaying around the floor of Congress, draped in the Ukrainian flag. I mean, it seemed like she was really throwing the kitchen sink here.
Yeah, well, I mean, Carrie Lake is an entertainer. You know, she was on television for 20 years, so she knows how to paint a picture for her audience. And she was referencing Gallego with a Ukrainian flag and his support after, I think, some funding for Ukraine passed. And, yeah, she's trying to point out that, you know, he's supporting another country and not us over here. But as you said, I think she's taking big swings because she sees herself down in the polls, whether she will admit that or not. And so she's trying to paint her opponent as this, you know, sashaying Ukrainian partisan versus someone fit to be a United States senator.
So you've mentioned a couple times questions that Gallego took after the debate. Did he make any news with his answers to those questions?
I think the biggest thing he said was, as I mentioned before, that, you know, he's going to support Roe-style protections at the federal level, whether or not Arizona passes its law, because he said, basically said, you know, a woman who needs an abortion in Texas shouldn't get sepsis because she can't access it there, that this should be a protection for everyone.
So last few seconds, Wayne. Bottom line, do you think this debate changed the state of the race?
Short answer, no. They kind of talked the lines they've been talking on the campaign trail. None of the positions were all that surprising. And, you know, Lake was who Lake was, and Gallego was who he's been on this campaign, which is pretty disciplined, and just kind of stood back and let her do her thing.
KJZZ's Wayne Shutsky, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This year's ballot is a long one, with lots of candidates running for lots of offices. But there are also races in which there is just one candidate, and some elections where nobody has stepped forward to run. That got us thinking about why people choose to run for office and why they choose not to. And to talk about that, I'm joined by two veterans of Arizona politics, Fred Duvall and Kevin DeMena. Duvall is currently a regent, but he ran for governor in 2014 and has also served in behind-the-scenes political roles, including in the Clinton administration. DeMena is a longtime lobbyist and political observer. His firm is called DeMena Public Affairs. And Fred, let me start with you. You've run for office before. What prompted you to do it?
If you care about the place that you live, you inevitably get drawn into the civic square, and that manifests in a variety of different things, nonprofits, philanthropic groups, et cetera. But in the end, power resides with people who stand for public office. If you believe in things and change and ideas, it's the place where you go to make the changes that you envision for the world that you live in. And so it's a very, very sort of attractive thing to grow up and live in a democracy where you can say, I've got something I want to say. Here's how you do it. You fill out your form and you go run. It just getting increasingly difficult. It's not that simple.
Right. Well, and you've also been somebody who has been in the political world behind the scenes, not as an elected official, but helping people who have been elected. I'm curious how you see the difference between being the person up front whose name is on the ballot and the person who's maybe helping the person whose name was on the ballot.
Mark, it's a great point and question, because I thought, having been in more campaign meetings than I can count, working for more politicians than I can count, local, presidential, et cetera, I thought, I know what this is going to be about. I'm ready for this. It is fundamentally different. It's your reputation that gets hit. It's your social media blasts that get promoted. It's your spending time on the telephone asking people for money. It's intensely personal. It's exhilarating. It was described to me as sort of, you know, being a Walenda. There's nothing quite like being on the rope, you know, dangling
over the Grand Canyon.
Yeah, over the Grand Canyon. So it is ultimately exhilarating, but fundamentally different when it's you, your family, your pocketbook, and everything that comes with it.
So, Kevin, you are somebody who has been in politics for a long time, but exclusively behind the scenes. Does what Fred is saying ring true to you in terms of maybe some of the reasons why people choose to maybe take your path as opposed to the putting your name on the ballot path?
It's a difficult question to, you know, answer in sort of a just simple way. The fact is, I lack the courage to knock on your door and discuss immigration with you. I have been consistently impressed with individuals that can do that and succeed. You know, that's the granular side, but you're putting yourself out there in a way that demonstrates your commitment. But there is a part of our world where we all have that interest in doing good, and there are other ways that manifests itself. For those of us that are political observers, civil servants, whatever you want to call it, but the folks on point, like my good friend Mr. DeVal here, now have much more at risk. It's much more difficult. And so as a result, I expect them to be much more choosy about whether to take the plunge or not.
Well, so Kevin, when prospective candidates come to you, maybe especially those who haven't run before, what do you tell them, or how do you try to prepare them for what they can expect once they start running?
The first question is always, tell me about your family. If you have four children under, you know, in school, and you intend to engage at the legislative level, at state government level, it's manageable. But the trips to Washington, that requires a different level of commitment and interest. All of these positions come with the word honorable permanently affixed to the front of your name. And so with so many people, that matters too much, and that makes it worth spending the week in D.C. on matters that might seem more important than your children, but that's not a decision I've ever been able to make. The first thing I say when I interview someone is just talk with me about the age of your family and your ability to sustain this.
Fred, do you find that people who run for office, like, are they doing it for the right reasons? Are they doing it because they really want to make a difference, or are they maybe doing it because they like having the word honorable in front of their name?
All the above. And sometimes it takes all the above. You know, you got to believe in something. I think that is first and foremost. The candidates who aren't clear on their purpose and on their why get flushed out. You've got to sort of think through the hard work of why are you doing this, and why are you putting everybody around you, to Kevin's point about family, through what you're about to do.
Yeah.
So the why is really, really important. I think the good ones have to be fundamentally optimistic, whatever your ideology. I think you've got to believe that the efforts will manifest in something useful. And frankly, that's increasingly hard because nothing gets done, particularly in Washington. You know, so much of politics has become sort of performance art as opposed to purpose and outcomes. And then to Kevin's point, he asks about family, which is appropriate. My second quick follow-up is, can you afford it? It is an assault on your wallet in ways that folks don't really appreciate.
I got to say, the two of you are making running for office sound incredibly appealing here. I mean, you're talking about how expensive it is and how
difficult it is and how, you know, you get trolled on social media and you get all sorts of nasty yes. things said about you. Do you find, Kevin, that people are less willing now to go through all of that? Like, are we dealing with a dearth of quality candidates here?
It's a fascinating thing because no, the cup runneth over. It's just a completely different level of interest. And they're kind of two interesting extremes. There are folks that are so put off by the principled side, the absence of dignity, that's got them off the bench.
Because it's gotten so bad, they are drawn in to try to make it better?
Exactly. The other aspect is that money, this is my 44th year doing this, money was absolutely the critical question. And now it's not an afterthought, but raising money and funding messaging at any level, state, federal, isn't that hard. It's too easy to access the money. And in fact, that allows things to happen that just shouldn't happen.
And let me pick up on that, because I was going to say something similar. It's exactly right. We have become so cause-oriented, so existential in our politics, right and left, considers the other side to be a threat to the existence of everything that we know and prize in our culture and our politics. That lends itself to the kind of fundraising that Kevin's talking about, and it lends itself to an impossibility of ever working with the other side to try and solve problems. So it is an inducement to run, and it is a disinducement to serve.
Well, I was going to say, it sounds like that kind of creates this vicious cycle where more people are drawn to run. But then, as you both alluded to, it's really hard to actually get anything done, whether you're at the state capitol or the U.S. capitol, which then, at least for some politicians, causes them to walk away in disgust.
Well, yes. And so much of...
Do you want to get Mitt Romney on the phone? Do you mean to interrupt? Go ahead.
No, and actually, Mitt Romney, I was reading an interview about him this morning, and he made two great points on this very topic. The first, he said, so much of what happens now in Washington is fake.
Mm-hmm.
And the second is, he pointed out, which I had not realized, that this is the highest number of resignations in the Congress that we've seen in a generation. So people are hitting a wall and saying, this is no longer satisfying. The cost benefit of this is no longer positive and no longer an inducement to serve, which is a sad thing.
That is Fred Duvall. I'm also joined by Kevin DeMeta. More of our conversation in just a moment. Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Coming up, we'll hear from a comedian whose use of psychedelics is a key component of both his act and his philosophy on life.
But first, let's return now to my conversation with Arizona Regent and former gubernatorial candidate Fred Duvall and political observer Kevin DeMeta, talking about why candidates choose to run for office and why they don't. And Kevin, if candidates are inclined to run and interested in going through everything you two have described, how are those people choosing which office to run for?
The dynamic now, I have worked with folks on school boards, and their dedication is just amazing, the hours. And then eventually their child graduates and goes on to college, and someone else takes that school board spot. But their interest, their passion at the legislature, water, you know, if you've been a rancher, emergency room docs, want to change what you know needs to be changed. The ability to monetize your position has changed that. The inducement to serve, noblesse oblige, and this is public radio, so I'm sure everyone knows what that means, but just in case, you know, what it really means is as you are privileged, you pay it forward. You have this inherent, hardwired obligation to serve those that have helped make your life so good. Now, that's what we should be looking for and relying upon. The model that exists now is that you can raise hundreds of thousands of dollars out of state, wherever state you are, and Arizona is the recipient of this. We have legislators that are filing 600-page donor reports. A couple of those pages are Arizona donations. And the money and the ability to move that is unrelated to what I would simply describe as noblesse oblige. It has become a lifestyle.
So, Kevin, you mentioned that we are not having an issue with having enough people running for office. And I'm not going to ask you to name names or throw anybody under the bus here. But I'm curious, do we have the right kinds of people running for office? Like, we have the quantity. Do we have the quality?
So it's not a hard question to answer. By and large, we do. But here is the lens. You have to evaluate this in a couple of stages. In January, they'll get oriented after Thanksgiving. They'll meet their assistant, and they'll begin legislating the day after. They don't yet know where bills come from, the products, and they don't have a good idea of the path ahead. So it makes it very difficult to be effective in the first regular session. By the second regular session, they have discovered the location of the restrooms and all of this. So we have a challenge in terms of distinguishing those that can really cover ground and those that can't. But I'll tell you what is becoming much more clear. There is an interest in opening this up so that they can become that person.
Let me build on that, Mark. I admire people who run, admire people who serve, and I have found that almost everyone who does so is a decent, well-intentioned, patriotic, informed person doing it for good reasons. There are some exceptions. I mean, ego gets in the way, ideology sometimes gets extreme. But generally speaking, pretty terrific people who are then thrust into a set of incentives which test who they are and how rooted they are in how what kind of a elected official they want to be. The lure of how to raise money requires certain behavioral patterns. The lure of how to get along with your caucus requires certain choices, certain votes, et cetera. The incredibly destructive lure of social media. You create news with friction, not with solutions. And the lure towards friction drives money. It drives a whole bunch of things. So the incentive package, it is what it is, but it's not conducive to, you know, collaborative behavior. And so folks get tested.
So, Fred, do you think then that people maybe run for the right reasons? But it almost sounds like you're saying the system into which they're being thrust maybe makes it hard to govern for the right reasons or govern in the right way maybe because of the need to, for example, constantly fundraise so that they can get reelected or knock on, you know, go and knock on doors or deal with, you know, everything that's being said about them online, things like that.
It does make it hard. I'll tell you a story. I ran for governor about 10 years ago, and I really wanted to try and be thoughtful and put a bunch of ideas forward, and I had a bet with my consulting team. They said, look, here's what we'll do. We'll do one direct mail piece your way. You can talk about groundwater and education reform and, you know, the future of the state land department, whatever you want to talk about. And then we'll do one where we'll call the other side evil people. Well, mine raised about $2,000. Theirs raised about $20,000. You know, okay. That's a
point, point made.
Yeah, point made.
This is politics, and no matter how we want to recast it, elevate it, throw around terms like noblesse oblige, it is politics. It's not a corporate way of doing business. I think the point is the process itself needs to be more welcoming. This is not an easy thing to get into given where our parties are. The normal entry points are vanishing, and what that does, by the way, is make people who don't work for the government more influential.
People like you.
The lobbying corps has disproportionate influence when the legislative corps steps back.
Interesting. All right, we'll have to leave it there, guys. Kevin DeMena, Fred DeFall, thanks to you both for coming in. Thanks for the conversation. I really appreciate
it. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Well, you might remember the results of the 2020 election, but not likely the winner in 1920. Now try to remember the losers of these races. Well, there's an art installation in the Valley that's determined to showcase them in the form of one big campaign sign graveyard. The show's Athena Ankra found out more about it.
Right now, there are plenty of political signs stuck in front yards and packed on street corners across the state, but one home here in the Midtown Phoenix neighborhood of Coronado stands out. And not just because the little lawn is packed with more than 50 different signs.
The signs are so bright, they're so colorful, and they're just everywhere on this lawn. It's like just this riotous cacophony of kind of insanity a little bit. But then you kind of start to like see a method to the madness.
That's Keisha Turley, assistant curator at the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art. On second glance, you'll notice that some of the campaign signs are not of this century, and that none of these signs belong to candidates who were successful.
I mean, I have, you know, Adams in 92, and what people don't know is that that's 1792.
That's Carrie Tovar, one of the owners of the house. Turns out it's not a visual display of an enthusiastic neighbor's political fervor compelling you to vote for a specific candidate, but rather an art installation. It's a collection of fake signs for every losing presidential ticket since the country's founding. The installation Monument to the Unelected was created by Brooklyn-based interdisciplinary artist Nina Cacciadorian. It was originally commissioned in 2008 by the Scottsdale Museum of Contemporary Art.
I was invited to be part of an exhibition at SMOCA called Seriously Funny.
Cacciadorian says she was inspired by the abundance of election signs in town that year, especially considering Arizona's own John McCain was running for president.
While all that was going on, these election signs were kind of almost following me around town everywhere I went. And I thought, what if I made a series of election signs with the names of everybody who ever ran for the office of president of the United States, but who lost?
SMOCA has brought Monument to the Unelected back to the Valley and other locations across the country during presidential election season, from early October until the winning ticket is announced. But Cacciadorian says the piece is often misunderstood as an endorsement or indictment of past campaigns. But in fact, Monument to the Unelected isn't meant to say anything particularly political at all.
Although it's a piece about politics and a piece about elections, it's actually a very politically neutral piece. And what I mean by that is that you could feel happy or sad about the results of any of these names that are on the signs, any of the people who lost an election. But the piece does not take a position on that. I'm actually really just presenting a series of facts about the past.
Over the years, the installation has garnered a variety of reactions, but mostly confusion. Here's Keisha Turley again.
It's not every day that you see the front of a home inundated with yard signs, and you might kind of question, like, what is going on here? What is happening?
And the owners of the home say it's also been an opportunity for neighbors to connect, reflect, learn, and have a good laugh.
About 4 years ago, so the last election cycle, we decided to install Nina Cacciadorian's Monument to the Unelected, and we gave her a selection of houses in which to choose from because she has a vision of what she would like it to look like, and she chose our house. It was surprising at how many people, I think, came to the house. What wasn't surprising to me was how engaged they became. There wasn't really any, like, political animosity. People were just interested in the history of America rather than any kind of political stance, because that's not really what it is. It's really just all of the paths that we could have taken that we didn't.
Their front yard, located near 12th Street and Thomas, will be chock full of signs from now until it's time to add a 60th sign for the newest election loser. Cacciadorian plans to ask 2 first-time voters to plant it. Just who those voters will be is yet to be decided, much like the election. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Athena Ankara.
Graham Rossini has taken over as athletic director at ASU at an interesting time. In May, he replaced Ray Anderson, who was fired after a recruiting scandal in the football program and underperformance by a number of teams on the field. It also comes as ASU is in its first season in the Big 12 Conference. The school, like all others, is also navigating the relatively new worlds of name, image, and likeness and the increasing conversations about paying student-athletes. Rossini is an ASU alum, although this is his first AD job. I sat down with him in his office recently, overlooking the football field at Mountain America Stadium. I asked him what appeals about this job, since it's his first as athletic director.
first AD gig, but I'm a longtime Sun Devil. And so it allows me to combine my education, my area of interest, my career progression in a place that I love and have benefited from. So really a dream come true in many, many, many ways.
A lot of your experience before this job was sort of on the business side of sports. What has that taught you that has helped you so far?
Yeah, I've been lucky to be tied to a team in one way, shape, or another since I was 4 years old. And so team sports is really kind of the environment that I've grown up around. Been, you know, athletics is a big part of my background. Sports business was maybe my professional training. And I think drawing from the collection of that experience has really been helpful in the preparation for the role.
It seems as though this is an interesting time for the business of college athletics. A lot of stuff going on. What have you found that maybe you didn't expect about that coming in, and maybe what has been sort of as you expected?
I think it's actually been helpful to anticipate where college sports is headed. And, you know, my sports business background and building a team around the athletic department and the university that helps us evolve with this changing landscape that we're navigating. And we're not proponents that student athletes should become employees. We are aware that we need to sophisticate the way that we run the business of an athletic department. And that's all intended to create resources that we can reinvest in the young people. So I think a lot of it's just been using sports business, using, you know, attributes of professional sports, which I spent a lot of time in, and bringing that in ways that we can drive ticket sales, corporate partnerships, different donor and VIP experiences, all with the mindset of creating that we can reinvest into the young people that we're here to serve and lead.
So where do you think college sports is headed, especially as it relates to the relationship, I guess, between the student athletes and their universities?
Yeah, it's an evolving landscape, as we've mentioned, and where this lands, I don't think anybody's got that crystal ball quite yet figured out. But we do understand that there is a tremendous sense of urgency in solidifying the landscape. There's class action lawsuits happening around the NCAA landscape right now. We're very close to that. The Big 12, our conference, is very close to those conversations. And so we're getting almost daily insights into the changes that could be coming. But the changes will, in essence, create structure and guardrails and much more clarity in the environment that we're here to operate. And this is a time that we're navigating conference realignment. We're navigating the transfer portal, where our athletes have the opportunity to move on from an institution or join ASU at the same time. And then the era of name, image, and likeness, where a student athlete can utilize his or her social media profile or presence in a market to, you know, earn some resources and revenue in return. So not sure when it stabilizes. We're hopeful that it happens soon, but we're really tracking on a number of scenarios and solutions that fit for us at ASU.
Let me ask you about the NIL situation, because I know that's been a focus both for you and for the university.
Sure.
What are some of the ways that you're looking to try to help the current student athletes take advantage of that? And maybe how much are you trying to use that as a recruiting tool to get students to come here?
Yeah, I think there's a tremendous recruiting tool for us specifically here at ASU around how do we incorporate NIL into our message. And oftentimes, you know, we have almost 700 athletes across our 26 sports. We've got athletes from over 40 countries in the world, and many of them have specialized in their sport since they were a young age. And so you're looking at young people that are going to graduate very well educated. They've got a rich set of intangibles and innate skills as an athlete, but they haven't had the ability to work a part-time job in high school. They haven't had time to do an internship while they were studying. But NIL enters the conversation as a way for them to promote a product or service that they're aligned with, that they see value in, and then start to gain a professional network and some really, really valuable resume experience that helps prepare them for life after sport.
How important is having a strong NIL program to recruiting student athletes to come here?
It's critical. You know, there were moments in college sports where you were only recruiting on the quality of your coaching staff, then you were layering on the academic institution. There was an era where uniforms and facilities were really what captured the imagination of recruits. Now we need all those things, and also relevancy and name, image, and likeness. And I think we're very fortunate in having the full strength of ASU behind what we're doing here in athletics, support from President Crow and university leadership. But you pair that with the fact that we're in the Valley, this incredible metropolitan area. People are moving here by the millions over the last decade. We have a number of companies that are setting up shop, and it just creates an endless aisle of opportunities that we're eager to pursue.
I want to ask you about a plan that the University of Tennessee is putting into place, where they're basically adding a 10% surcharge to all of their ticket prices to pay for revenue sharing, a plan that's going into effect next year. I'm curious if you see anything like that at ASU, and if not, maybe what
how you envision making that work.
Yeah, we're hyper-focused on generating more revenue any way that we can. And we really believe that there's an opportunity to focus on the game day and the community support that surrounds ASU. And there's no secret that a full Mountain America Stadium on a football game day, a full Desert Financial Arena on a basketball game day, economically, those are the most important outcomes for us to focus on. They're also the most important outcomes that our fans are asking us to make that investment into football, to make that investment into men's and women's basketball. So we really believe that a lot of great energy and attention into our football and basketball game days economically creates the resources that we need to compete in all 26 of our sports.
Does that maybe give you pause then in terms of making ticket prices more expensive or putting additional surcharges on, for example?
Yeah, I don't know that the price point is the end all be all. I think we look at the volume that we can accomplish over the course of the year. And that's where we have the benefit of when you have multiple sports, we have seven that we believe should be selling out the stadiums or the arenas. And that's because we have competitive sports. We've got great coaching staffs and we've got talented young people representing us. But we want to pair that with an incredible game day, an incredible fan experience, and then over the course of the entire academic year, have a situation where we're pushing volume and we can create resources over volume and not have to be gouging on ticket prices, parking. You know, we've cut our parking prices in half. We're lowering the prices of our concessions because we see more value in playing the long game of making a game day enjoyable, easy to navigate, affordable, and energetic and exciting. The combination of those things, I think, are more important than just pushing only ticket pricing or only one aspect of the operation.
You mentioned conference realignment. This is, of course, ASU's first year in the Big 12.
Sure.
How's that move going?
It's been exciting. You know, it's just given us a lot of exposure, a lot of additional opportunity to pursue. This morning, we were studying our television ratings in the early part of the football season. And when you're in a national conference, you know, we span as far east as Florida, West Virginia, Ohio, heavy concentration throughout Texas and the Midwest, and then obviously the four corner schools that we're joining with. The benefit of a national conference is starting to bear some fruit where our television ratings are up about 152% year over year. And that's because our games are now on ESPN and Fox and those networks, and they're not on a regional sports network. And so the national exposure has been an immediate benefit. And then even having football games in the state of Texas, you can't put a recruiting value on the chance to compete in these recruiting hotbeds in a state like Texas. And you know, in many different ways, we're starting to see the benefit of this national footprint, the exposure that we're able to create as a result of the distribution of the Big 12. And so far, so good.
All right, fair enough. That is Graham Rossini, the new ASU athletic director. Graham, thanks for your time. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Sam Dingman. Comedian Shane Moss brings his multimedia comedy show to Walter Studios tonight. The show is called A Better Trip, and as the title suggests, much of it is built around psychedelics. Moss has built a reputation as a kind of goofball philosopher, blending personal storytelling, brain science, and acid-infused insights in his stand-up specials and podcast episodes. But a Shane Moss show is more than just the comedic equivalent of a Jerry Garcia solo. He's not just aimlessly noodling on big ideas. He has a bigger point to make about the intersection of comedy, science, and psychedelics. Moss sees powerful connections between these things and believes that integrating our understanding of all three can help us make sense of ourselves. And he knows that, he told me recently, because that's what they've done for him.
I felt very alienated my entire life. I didn't really feel like the narrative of what life was about agreed with me very well. I was from like a cartoonishly wholesome Midwestern upbringing where like questioning anything was exceptionally taboo, and I always felt like I had a very absurd sense of humor that only my close friends could get. And I always wanted to have these philosophical conversations about life. And I remember doing mushrooms for the first time and just looking around and it just feeling like I felt heard by my mushroom experience. I was like, I knew life was weird.
Yeah.
And mushrooms has just confirmed it for me. I knew that our perceptions and our beliefs were very like malleable and not so set in stone and not to be taken so seriously.
I have to say, Shane, this is really fascinating to talk to you about, because I think we're about the same age. I'm 42. You know,
I'm 44.
Okay. You know, like the thing I remember thinking about back, you know, when
folks our age were starting to experiment with drugs, particularly psychedelics, is that there was such a difference. Like, people from our parents' generation, they thought of these as like holy sacraments that were going to like save the world, you know, that were going to like completely unlock this new level of global consciousness. And for folks our age, it was more what you're talking about. It was almost more of like a way of finding personal affirmation.
You know, that generation was more Beatles and yeah. Pink Floyd and like loving one another to rally against the war machine or whatever. And my generation was more like Nirvana, you know, just rebelling just generally. And there was something just about those effects that you would have on marijuana that would make some of those things you know, that much more tangible.
Wait, did you just hear that echo that just happened? That was amazing.
I did it myself.
Okay. Fantastic. I was like, did I?
I was just adding a little something to the interview. I have a voice processor here that I thought would be funny to make
did Shane somehow send LSD to the studio and put
voice
it in my coffee?
I know. I just wanted to mess with you a little bit. I hope you don't mind.
Oh, not at all. Not at all. Well, so this is fascinating to me because I often think of stand-up, and tell me if you disagree, as a way of kind of arguing for your own point of view when it seems like nobody else agrees with you. So was there any similarity between those impulses?
So the material of this show, I kind of say it's a blend of comedy and science about psychedelics. And so often when people are like, well, why, how do those things go together? I think that they are all in their own way doing this thought experiment of this alien anthropologist, which is they look at behaviors most of us take for granted, mm-hmm. and they think about, what if an alien came down and was observing our behavior? You know, this is like the classic Seinfeld setup. Like, hey, have you ever noticed this? Why are escalators this way? Uh-huh. And these like otherwise mundane things that no one else cares to even notice or think too much about. And you see them through this different lens that brings out kind of the absurdity in the everyday. And I would say that psychedelics force that kind of alien anthropologist perspective on you.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the classic Ram Dass story about doing LSD for one of the first times and having this thought, who's minding the store? And realizing that there is this kind of double consciousness that is happening, that he is still himself and he is still alive and a human being, but he's also noticing all these elements of being a human being that he never thinks about otherwise.
And this is like what I'm absolutely obsessed with. I think that as I got into comedy and started, you know, writing jokes about human behavior, I just got deeply interested in that subject and started reading a lot of science books just about, you know, psychology and neuroscience and behavioral economics, kind of like why we spend money or save money in peculiar ways that doesn't necessarily match what some robot would spit out as the most sensible choice. And
yep.
Like, I'm such a sucker for anytime I go into a convenience store and there's a new candy, I'm like, I have to try it. In my mind, I think it's going to be like some great technological advancement that has just taken place in the candy world.
Yeah.
And it never does. Candy's fine. It's been, they figured candy out a long time ago.
Yeah.
It's rare to find a good new one. And I fall for that every damn time. And so like, why? And then you kind of look at it and like, why the brain might be a sucker for kind of novelty. I might think about some of the evolutionary underpinnings of why we have a preference for high sugar things that might be mismatched with our modern environment where we are now sometimes the victim of our own abundance.
I've had that experience that you're describing with candy too. And we even have a name for it, right? Sugar high. It's like a fake rush. But like, the thing that maybe science and psychedelics and stand-up comedy all have in common, at least, you know, when done well, is that it's not a sugar high. I mean, like, if you go to see a really great stand-up comedian, you are going to have your perspective challenged, sometimes in a really confronting and profound way. If you go to hear a really great scientist speak, there you're going to walk out of the auditorium not seeing the world the same way. And if you take a really powerful psychedelic under safe circumstances, it's going to be the same thing.
Yeah. I mean, as I get older too, I think that my take has become more and more balanced, which is like, when you have a psychedelic experience, when you see this hilarious comedian, when you hear some new science talk on a new subject, like, you know, be there in the moment and appreciate all that. And then also, like, even if you learn something new or have some new perception, you don't need to replace all of your existing framework of reality with whatever the new take that just entered your brain is. You'll hear a lot of people will have a psychedelic experience, be like, oh my God, I just saw the truth. And I doubt it. Like, you probably got a different perspective, and I think that's incredibly valuable. But you don't want to replace an old dogmatic belief with a new dogmatic belief. You'll hear a lot of people be like, comedians, they're the real truth tellers. It's like, well, they're honest. There's a difference between honesty and truth.
All right. Well, Shane Moss will be bringing his show A Better Trip to Walter Studios on Thursday, October 10th. Shane, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Sam, we got to look into getting a voice processor in here.
Yeah, I've been looking all over for the button that modulates my voice, but I can't find it.
No, I think you're going to be looking for a while if you're looking for that in here. Sorry.
I'm going to keep looking.
We'll work on it. We'll try to work on it.
Okay.
All right. That'll do it for this Thursday edition of the show. Thank you, as always, for listening. For Lauren Gilger and Sam Dingman, I'm Mark Brody. Have a terrific rest of your day. Hope to have you right back here tomorrow. That's it for this episode of The Show podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.